What is going on, everybody? It is your boy, Big Dave Martell, here on another episode of The Bog. Don't worry, everybody. I just made it out of the hospital. I know everybody was sending me their well wishes and their prayers and their good vibes. And I want to say many, many thank yous and many blessings to all my wonderful friends that reached out to me. But look at me. I'm 100%. I'm back. We're doing The Bog. And we got a really, really great episode for you guys tonight. Like we do every single Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. Unfortunately, Mr. Griff couldn't make it tonight. My awesome co-host. He got stuck with some other obligations. But he will be back next week for you guys. But before we get started, I want to give a shout out to my home girl, Miss Hannah, at traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Make sure you go over there and get some of this stuff, man. It's for us, by us. Stop giving your money to these multinational globalist corporations that put out propaganda that is against you. They hate you. They hate your guts. Stop giving them your money. They sell you plastics, synthetics, all kinds of stuff that trashes your hair, trashes your skin, trashes your body. Go over to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. I use it. My wife uses it. Dr. G uses it. His wife uses it. My mom uses it. We all use it. We all love it. It's doctor approved. Do it. Get it. Keep your white bright. Keep your beard robust and keep your mane flowing just like Big Dave. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave. But let's get started. My homegirl, Miss Sydney Horton. How are we doing tonight?
Doing awesome. Awesome. I appreciate this opportunity to be with you and to talk about everything we have to talk about, dude. There's a lot to talk about. So
yes,
awesome.
There is. Yes, there is. So me and Miss Horton, we've been buddies for a long time. We worked together over in the Revolutionary Conservative a few years ago. We've walked almost sort of like a parallel path, getting away from politics, back into spirituality, and we've stayed in contact, and she's been a wonderful, tremendous writer. She's a young lady, but she puts out really great content. She's a powerhouse. I've been tuning into her stuff for a long, long time, and it's just really awesome to have her here tonight. But Miss Horton practices what's called Hellenismos. Is that how you say it? Hellenismos.
Hellenismos, right.
Yeah, and Hellenismos is the Greek tradition. You over here at the Bog, we got a lot of people that practice the Germanic tradition. Our buddy Celtic Tigers from the Celtic tradition, and now tonight we're bringing you the Hellenic tradition or the Greek tradition. And we're gonna dig into all that tonight and all the stuff. And it's gonna be really, really exciting. But before we get started, let's do a quick overview. What is Hellenismos, and how did you find it? How did you get there?
Absolutely. So Hellenismos, as you said, is just primarily revolving around the ancient Greco-Roman traditions of pre-Christian antiquity. And it revolves around, of course, the polytheistic beliefs and the pre-existing gods, but also the Thonic, or the gods of the underworld, the worship and acknowledgement and reverence of the ancestors and the Greek heroes, and so on and so forth. And the primary idea behind the Hellenic philosophy is to adopt a life in the pursuit of arete, which is virtue, of a divine eros, or love and reciprocal affection and adoration between ourselves and the gods, and to establish the life of a philosopher, which is an individual who pursues these virtues and these tenets and these ideal forms of love and truth, virtue, moderation, honesty, and justice, etc., and to pursue the concerns of the soul rather than the immediate gratifications of the physical body and the physical world. Mm-hmm. So this is ultimately the ultimate aspiration of the person. As for myself, I have been involved in Hellenismos for about 2 years now. I converted a couple of years ago. Interestingly enough, I converted immediately before Charlottesville. And what kind of led me to that point was rather interesting, because I grew up in a very stereotypically Southern Baptist Protestant household, just like most people, you know, in the South. And I never really found any kind of organic sincerity in terms of my interactions with that particular monotheistic faith. For me, I just never found anything really satisfactory in it. And so after a period of time and studying scripture meticulously, I kind of abandoned that in pursuit of something that I felt would give me the sincerity and the passion and the truth and transparency that I was searching for. And during that period of time, I studied just a variety of different texts and different religious faiths and different traditions. I studied some of the Eastern traditions and Buddhism and Hinduism. I developed an interest in polytheistic religions from that, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for. I studied basically anything I could get my hands on, a variety of different philosophies, and interestingly enough, also various occult ideas and philosophies. None of that was satisfactory to me in the least. And ultimately, I reached a point in which I kind of accepted that I was in this position of ignorance and not knowing, and yet still looking for what, for whatever that philosophy, that religion, that idea was that provided me with that. And so this went on for a few years. And interestingly enough, when I was in college, I was reading various different poets and literature and these things, being into the romantics, into Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Byron, and the like. And I noticed something so different in the way that they described the natural world, in the way that they described this kind of spiritual grandeur and just an exuberant vibrancy in the natural world. And that captivated me in such a fascinating way. But after that, I started noticing that they were alluding to these ancient gods. They were alluding to Poseidon and to Zeus and Triton and to Athena and Apollo. And I started seeing something that was almost like a synchronicity, that as I was learning to view the world with a new set of eyes in nature, I started to perceive a beauty in these gods and these goddesses. And I developed an absolutely just spontaneous and organic love of these beings, these deities. And I started just going outside every day and just randomly burning incense and writing poetry and just absolutely just writing whatever I felt the spontaneous inspiration to write. And this went on for a few weeks. And this was about, I would say, 2 months before Charlottesville this occurred. And when Charlottesville rolled around, I remember the night prior to Charlottesville. It was immediately after all of the violence initially had broken out and everything, and it was clear that it was going to be a very chaotic situation. And I recall being in just this kind of state of anxiety, and I prayed to Goddess Athena, and I asked her specifically for her golden helm and for her aegis, for protection in battle and over myself, over those with me, and for preservation in the midst of all this warfare and chaos. And the next day, my security team brought me this helmet. I initially didn't think anything of it because everyone was dressed, you know, according to that kind of attire due to the severity. And I got through that, you know, through that situation. All of those with me, my friends, as well as my security team, made it out of there virtually unscathed, while many other people were unfortunately subject to all this heinous violence and everything. And so we left Charlottesville. I returned home the next day, and I was sitting at my desk, and I was about to make the political video that would essentially land me on the map in terms of political analysis in general, discussing what had actually happened in Charlottesville. And I was holding that helmet in my hands, and I happened to flip it upside down. And on the inside of that helmet was a label with the Greek word aegis. And wow. It was the it was the astonishing moment in which the metaphysical was manifest into the physical world for me. And it was astonishing. It absolutely just floored me. I could not believe it. It just absolutely blew my mind. And I had this realization at that point, this declaration, in which I could almost hear Goddess Athena say to me, "This path will be wrought with difficulty, with opposition, with animosity and aggression. But how else would you seek to bring glory to a goddess of warfare, if not upon the battlefield?" And I had this profound revelation at that point that everything that we engage in, whether that be a physical warfare, cultural, philosophical, religious, spiritual one, irrespective, all of these things ultimately will lead to that glory, because the gods do not grant us glory in itself, but rather the weapons with which to fight for it. And that revelation for me gave me joy. It gave me what we refer to in Elenismos as kind of a bacchic ecstasy, a spiritual euphoria in glorifying the struggle, in the sense of earning our place, not only in Western civilization, but in history, in fighting honorably and in virtue for the things which matter to us. So that was kind of my introduction to Elenismos. And I have to say that since I embarked upon this path, despite it being relatively recent in comparison to many people who have been on this path for decades, my experience has been nonetheless an absolutely incredible one. It has absolutely just drastically transformed who I am as a human being and how I perceive the world. And I'm incredibly appreciative of that.
Yeah. You know, your story isn't uncommon to, you know, here on The Bog, I sometimes do call-in shows, and I have a lot of people send me messages and tell me about their, could we talk about spiritual experiences a lot? We don't just wax and wane philosophically all the time or talk about history or whatever. I like to hear what people's spiritual experiences are, and there's a great awakening going on. I'm sure you're very familiar, you know, being into paganism. You see the amount of people that practice Asatru. We're like the largest one so far, so, you know, here in the States anyways. So what I've been hearing is stories that are very similar, not necessarily just like yours, but these like really profound otherworldly experiences, as you mentioned, right? You put it perfectly. You said the metaphysical manifesting into reality, and people say that all the time, and I get to hear all of these great spiritual experiences. I've had my own. I've had many of them that have brought me on this path, so it's just really incredible that our people are having the, whether it's, you know, you're practicing Hellenismos or Asatru Setianism, or if you're getting into you know, the Celtic stuff, there's so many people having these experiences, and it really shows me, and it's just, it's truth to me. It's evidence that the ancient gods are waking up and they're coming back and we're approaching a new age. So before we get too far into like our experiences and stuff like that, and I want to talk about the philosophies of Hellenismos, because I know very, very little. I've read some Plato. I mean, I've read some of the myths and stuff like that. I've seen some videos that had like English subtitles of, what are they called? Hellenismos Ethnikos or something like that. And I know a little bit, but could you give us kind of like an overview of what kind of the philosophical worldview of Hellenismos is, and maybe what similarities it has with Asatru, and maybe some differences?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm kind of on the opposite end of that, whereas I don't know quite as much about Asatru, but I definitely know there are some definitive similarities there. And the core of Hellenismos is very fascinating, because the beautiful thing about it is that it truly encompasses an entire culture. It encompasses art and science and philosophy and religious tradition and all these things that truly make the Hellenic world one that is so invigorated with a genuine love and adoration of life. And that in itself is just an incredibly beautiful thing. And of course, we don't have a centralized like scriptural text or anything like that. It's just more about the overall conduct that is described in the work of the philosophers, whether that be Plato or Aristotle, whether that be Plutarch or any of the other individuals that are involved in that, whether that be through the analysis of the myths, the discussion of the playwrights, things of that nature. It all just kind of comes together in a very beautiful way that is very coherent. It's really wow. Beautiful, but we do often look, for example, at like the Delphic Maxims, which are a series of 157 short but very profound statements that are attributed to the god Apollo, who is the god of light and truth, as it is attributed through the oracle of Delphi, or the Pythia. It's very beautiful to read into the Delphic Maxims, because they really provide three kind of different categories by which we establish our behavior and act accordingly. And I break those down into these categories of how one perceives themselves, how you perceive your neighbor, and how you perceive your nation. And they're very short and succinct and to the point, and yet have what I call kind of a sacred simplicity to them that truly brings out this very genuine and virtuous side of man. And as I said, you know, that's the ultimate goal in Hellenismos, is to really strive for arete, strive for virtue. And that's based upon the Delphic Maxims, which teach essentially to demonstrate moderation and self-discipline, to control oneself, because ultimately our pursuit is to pursue the interests of the soul, to kind of reach this point of a reciprocal relationship with the gods, this synchronicity, if you will, with the matters concerning the soul, rather than the physical body. And we accomplish that through moderation, through self-control, through virtue. To know thyself means to recognize your own mortality, to recognize the state that we possess as human beings, this kind of warfare that we're engaged in, as far as the warfare between the matters of the soul and the matters of virtue, and remaining in a state of humility rather than one of hubris, which is one of the most powerful tenets of Hellenismos. And this is demonstrated repeatedly in the myths, whether you're talking about Medusa or Arachne, Icarus or Narcissus, or even the great Greek hero Bellerophon. All of them kind of reflect the same lesson, that the gods despise hubris. And this is the number one problem with the modern world, is that we live, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, we live in a culture that is absolutely saturated with hubris, with an egomaniacal tendency to only focus on immediate and instantaneous gratification. And that's the disease.
I don't know if you watch my videos. I call that anus worship.
Yes. it is. To be completely honest. Like, that's exactly what it is. And that's what we find, you know, despicable. That's what the gods defined as tasteful and despicable. And it was for that reason that so many people in the mythos just ultimately reached this point of just a tragic death because of a reliance and a contingency upon hubris. So that's the main point, I think, that we really strive to drive home in Elenismos, is demonstrating moderation and self-control, but also the virtues of a philosophical life, to be able to stand kind of outside of our own minds in terms of perceiving truth without a bias. So Crates discusses this thoroughly in the Platonic texts as well. And it's for that reason that the Athenian state put him to death, because ultimately, you know, this goal to strive for this state of purity, to be concerned with the matters of the soul, transcends that. But going back for a moment, this is primarily the first category, the perception of oneself. The second one is contingent upon the perception of other people and our behaviors towards our neighbors and our friends and people of that nature, to demonstrate generosity and hospitality, to understand the sacred nature of being hospitable towards our brothers and our sisters, to demonstrate a humility, a sincerity, and a generosity towards those people, to build, if you will, kind of a communal identity with those people. We no longer have quite the same capacity that we did in the ancient days for the worship of the polis, for the city, to have the same kind of city-wide worship. But the main idea and core to that is essentially just this communal sense of a unity, of an identity. The same thing can be said in the Eleusinian Mysteries, this kind of collective exaltation of the gods, if you will. And I think you'd also agree that's something else we're missing in the main day, is the modern day, this communal sense of identity. And that's something that many people attempt to fill with substitutions for political identity and ideology of that nature. And again, we both agree, you know, that's something that's completely asinine and it's counterproductive in the modern day to what we're trying to accomplish.
I'm loving this. I don't mean to like chuckle, right? It's just what you're talking about is literally, you know, it's like, I don't want to, not word for word, but it's very, very much at its core exactly the same kind of stuff that we talk about, and the kind of, you mentioned a word there. You said reciprocation with the gods. That is a huge aspect of our faith as well. It's we say a gift for a gift. You give and the gods return with a gift. And it's the same thing you're supposed to return with your folk and your community. And you're talking about a spiritual communal thing. We believe in this folk consciousness. Like, this is really just this is incredible right now to hear you describe these kind of universal, I guess you could say, principles of your faith that are very much parallel to what ours are. So this is just really exciting for me. I'm sorry. Go on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the beautiful things, is that irrespective of how the framework may differ in terms of the names of our gods or things of that nature, ultimately we share so many commonalities philosophically and spiritually. And that's the beautiful thing about it. But ultimately, that's what it comes down to, really, is that reciprocal relationship that we establish that is based upon this divine eros, this divine love. This is discussed in a few different texts in terms of Elenismos, but one in particular on the gods and the world. This one particular Platonic text that talks about this, and it talks about the purpose of ritual, the purpose of these rites, is ultimately reciprocation. Plato also discusses this in the Symposium. Of all of these things, the point of these rites and these rituals are to establish this divine eros, this love and exaltation of the gods, in this state of transparency and humility, in the perpetual path to better ourselves, this path of self-improvement, is ultimately what we aspire to. And there's such a joy in that. And that's what's beautiful about it, is that we see the gods as these whole benevolent beings. We see such a joy, a radiance in them. And that's what we call in Illanismos bacchic ecstasy, the spiritual euphoria. And that's the beautiful thing, is I find such a fulfillment in that, that is so wholesome and so complete in itself, this complete framework that does not require any additions or modifications from the modern world. It doesn't require any modern occult systems. It doesn't require any corrections. Our ancestors knew, you know, the completion of this system, the worship and the rituals and the rites of these gods. And they were absolutely correct in what we have read of them, despite that not being quite as much as we wish that we had. The fragments that remain demonstrate to us just how powerful and timeless these things are. But going further, the third kind of compartment or category that we could look at in terms of the morality described in the Delphic Maxims is the perception of ourselves towards the nation and how we perceive the nation. And this is an interesting point because Illanismos talks about the importance of the nation in terms of spiritual identity, in terms of this collective identity of our people as being a sacred bond. And that, to me, is an incredibly beautiful thing. And I'm sure it's very similar in Asatru. I wouldn't know because I don't know quite as much about Asatru, but I'd imagine it would be.
Sounds like you're describing the folk.
Yes, exactly. It would be similar in that way. So that's, you know, basically the three compartments, if you will, that I perceive from the Delphic Maxims in our behaviors towards ourselves, towards our neighbors, and towards the nation. And it's a very beautiful thing. It's a very complete system in itself. And that, to me, is just so fulfilling. I find such a joy in it. You know, it's something that you just want to share with other people because it provides you with such a fulfillment in life and such a euphoria in the sense of a spiritual purpose. And that, to me, is the most beautiful thing imaginable.
That's incredible. These three principles, we, you know, we have it all the time. People get it, you know, put on like little wall hangers or whatever. We say faith, family, folk. You know, your faith in the gods and your harmony with the cosmic principles and all of this stuff. And then your family, which is going to be like your, you know, your community, your just, I guess, your inner community, and then your folk, which is, as you would describe, your nation. Because as we all know, a lot of, if you extrapolate on the concept of nation, it very much means your folk, the people that you're tied by blood with, that you share a region with and stuff like that. So that's really incredible. That's really incredible. So what I wanted to kind of get into, this is, you know, what you're talking about is kind of like, you know, not just like you're talking about ritual and stuff like that. And that's what I wanted to kind of ask you about. In Asatru and Setianism, we have very you know, distinct ritual practices that we perform.
Right.
We have our bloat, we have our sumbul, we have our various practices that we do when we you know, try to communicate with the gods, and we should be very formulaic with it. And that's what we as Setians and us in the Nirvana Society focus on, is creating the correct formula. A lot of people say there's this big lie they got. This comes out of the occult kind of ideology, which is it doesn't matter what you do as long as there's intent. And yes, you should have intent. I mean, you shouldn't just be going through the motions. But the way I describe it is the gods are kind of like a friend on the other side of the world, and in order to contact them, you need to type in the right phone number. If you type in any phone number you want, you're not going to reach them. What you're trying to do is you're trying to reach across planes of existence to these extraplanar deities in order to speak with them and give them your gift and for them to gift back. And the ritual, the formula they use in the ritual, is the correct phone number to call them, the area code and everything. Is that something that you guys have as well, as far as a formulaic approach to ritual?
Yes, absolutely. And to elaborate a little bit further upon that, as I said, one of the most important tenets of Illanismos is that of moderation, of control, and of discipline. And going further into that, that includes the practice of ritual. Because the way that I perceive it is that you are raising your consciousness to a level in which you can commune with the gods. You are reaching a point in which you are entering into a state of formality, because they're worthy of that. They're worthy of a state of formality. To simply approach them in a state that is casual and nonchalant, just because you have sincere intent, to me, is not sufficient. You have, of course, to have the sincerity of intention and the purity of heart in order to do that. But we do have a basic framework by which we operate in terms of rituals. And I'm actually writing something about this right now to answer questions pertaining to this. But in Illanismos, the primary way by which we make sacrifices and offerings to the gods, and the most sacred act in ritual, is that of libation, of pouring out what offers. memories. And this is basically the solidification of the words that have, so to speak, been poured out from our souls unto the gods. And to solidify that communication, because what has been poured out of that vessel can never be returned to it. So these words that have been offered to the gods, and these supplications and these prayers have been permanently offered to them as a state of a definitive communication with them, so to speak. So there is a basic framework to this. In the beginning of our rituals, we always go through this kind of purification process in which we create a kedernet, or purified lustral water, we call it, which is basically where you cleanse yourself of what we in Illinois most refer to as miasma, which I would stress here is different from the idea of Christians' concept of sin or things of that nature. Not that the human being is an inherently evil creature, or not that miasma is an inherently evil thing, but rather it is an inevitable consequence of being a mortal being in the physical world. It is rather kind of a carnal debris that becomes attached to us through our interactions, activities, and associations with other people in the physical world. And so in the beginning of our rituals, we always perform this purification process. And that's integral and very, very important because we're not only cleansing the physical body, but that's also representative of the cleansing of the mind, so to speak, and the soul to enter into a state of communion with the gods.
Yeah.
And in our rituals, this is something I'm sure you will very much appreciate as well. Going back to the idea of communal worship, we have the incredible significance of the hearth fire and the hearth flame.
Yeah.
We worship goddess Estia, the goddess of the home and hearth. She's honored by every single one of the gods for not only being instrumental in teaching the rites of the gods to mankind, but also she's revered by all the gods. So in every single ritual that we perform, we first honor and invoke goddess Estia, and ask her for basically the right direction and the right words with which to commune with the gods. And we always pour out the first libation to her, to honor her first and foremost, before we commune with any of the other gods. And then from there, you know, you can essentially establish, you know, your prayers or supplications to whatever other gods you would in the Olympian pantheon, or the Thonic gods, the underworld deities, or the ancestors or the Greek heroes. And in the end of these rituals, we go through the same process that we began them with, which is in honoring goddess Estia. So the symbolism of the hearth fire, is very, very significant here. And I always make a point in my personal practice to emphasize two different hearths, and that is the hearth of the home and the hearth of the heart. In my personal practice, this is what I do. But honoring that, honoring the goddess of the home and the hearth, is absolutely integral to our personal worship in the oikos, or the household. So it's very, very important to do that. So that's kind of the basic framework in which we approach the gods. And interestingly enough, it's always in this state of humility, although the posture may be slightly different than it is in Asatru. I know I saw your post the other day about kneeling Yep. before the god. And that mentality remains the same, even though in Illinois, traditionally, we stand with our hands exalted towards typically the heavens if we're consulting with the Olympian gods, but also towards the earth if it's communing with the Thonic gods, with the gods of the underworld. But the same level and mentality of humility must be there always. And that is thoroughly demonstrated in the mythos with the punishment of people that demonstrate hubris and arrogance. And that's something I know you definitely feel very similarly about. So,
100%. Don't even get me started. Don't even get me started with these people with their they don't kneel. They refuse to submit to the gods, or they say, man, you know, you would kneel to the king to show reverence to a king. You would, you know, bow to an emperor. You would, you know, you show respect and reverence for things that are mighty and powerful and above you in the hierarchy. You are obviously below the gods in the hierarchy. And I think a lot of this stems from people that don't actually believe in gods, that they have these, you know, and I think, don't get me wrong. I think Carl Jung's theories are fascinating. And I think that he touched on a lot of really interesting stuff. I think he was absolutely a brilliant man. So nothing against him. However, the gods are deities first and foremost from our worldview, and these other theories are kind of secondary, or just something that you kind of delve into for interest's sake or whatever. Is that something that's similar to you? Would you say I am a stark theist, or do you have kind of like a gray area there?
I'm definitely a theist in this sense, and this is something that I see people discussing, because they conflate just an approach of Elenismos from a point of psychological study, as opposed and contrasted to that of an actual adherent to Elenismos. One of the questions that's most frequently asked is, do you believe the gods are mere archetypes, or do you believe them to be actual beings? No, we believe the gods are legitimate, valid beings in these incorporeal forms in this higher realm. This is not merely just a matter of them being archetypes or representative or whatever. One may consider the mythos in that perspective as being these parabolic representations and things of that nature, but we believe in the gods in this form, in this legitimate theistic form. And that's something I attempt to discuss quite often, because I think that when you start to see the gods in a way that is through the perception of this carnal containment, if you will, in this humanized form, in this way that is less than this incorporeal, impeccable form. I think that's kind of an area that can be rather hazardous spiritually, because people start to shift into what you mentioned earlier, which is this postmodern occultist perception of them. And it's something that utterly disgusts me. And interestingly enough, I just got into a debate about this yesterday with someone that professed to be a Hellenist, and this individual was actually Greek, and we were discussing this topic, and I noticed that in one of their documents pertaining to Hellenic ritual, they put an occult symbol, that being the symbol of Thelema, into the Hellenic laurel, and they were talking about magic via sigils, and I commented on this, and I said, why are you trying to combine chaos magic with the Hellenic, because those are two completely antithetical things. They're not in any way, shape, or form conducive to one another. They cannot coincide. They cannot coexist within the same system. And needless to say, they were very upset. They were so upset that they actually blocked my comments and deleted them and then kicked me out of the group because they were not happy. But this is a very unhealthy, very toxic, and very poisonous and counterproductive mentality. And honestly, it disgusts me to think that people seem to be under this impression that we can combine these very materialistic, egomaniacal systems that say that essentially I am a god. I can become one with the divine in the sense that I can be this deification. That mentality disgusts me because of the fact that in Elenismos, one of the most distasteful things is to consider oneself in that light. And I look at this from the perspective of, in the Greek mythos of Bellerophon, one of the most amazing Greek heroes. Throughout the adventures that he encountered in the slaying of these numerous beasts and monsters and things of that nature, he received the help of the gods. When he wanted to tame the Pegasus after it was born from the blood of Medusa, who was also coincidentally slain because of hubris, when he wanted to tame the Pegasus, goddess Athena gave him the means by which to do so. The gods helped him in his endeavors until he reached a point of hubris and the belief that because of his successful endeavors up until that point, he could commit the most egregious action of arrogance and fly Pegasus up to Olympus. And Zeus struck him down as a result of that action of hubris, and he was shamed by the gods for the remainder of his life. So this individual, this demigod, the son of Poseidon, that was in this position of glory, that was in this position of this direct communion with the gods, was not immune from falling due to hubris and arrogance and things of that nature. And it's just, that to me is so representative of the problem here, in that the plague of the modern world is hubris. The plague of the modern world is that this egomaniacal materialism, this consumerism, this insistence that all that I am concerned with morally, culturally, ethnically, spiritually, whatever, is my own personal instantaneous self-gratification. And that is the ultimate problem that we on every ancestral polytheistic path have to combat in the modern world.
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned before, within my lexicon that I kind of extrapolate upon in my own channel and on here sometimes, I call that anus worship, because I'm sure you're familiar with the stages of enlightenment. I mean, it's a silly, funny way of talking about it, but it's really, it's accurate. You are worshiping your own flesh. And what I describe people doing is they are prioritizing what I call the comfort worm, which is like kind of like a very like, I guess you could say it's a metaphysical parasite that drives these husks, these soulless people, to prioritize their own comfort, whether it be emotional, financial, physical, or even spiritual comfort. And a lot of times, these like really uber left-hand path pseudo-Satanist, you know, materialist people are just worshiping their own anus, they're worshiping their own flesh, and they're, you know, prioritizing their own comfort because they can't come to deal with the fact that they are indeed not the highest on the totem pole, that there are other entities, other creatures, other whatever, in other worlds that are higher than them. You know, they can't deal with that. They want to be king of the castle, and anything that tells them otherwise is offensive. And these are also the same people that deny eschatology, that deny, you know, afterlife. They say there is no afterlife, and like some of them will come around and they'll say, oh, well, I believe in reincarnation in the sense of genetic memory, and like this very kind of like scientific materialist way, which nothing against, I love science. I absolutely, you know, adore scientific thought, and I think that spirituality is in itself a very scientific method, is a way of a scientific approach of understanding the metaphysical. But these people use it as to kind of like weaponize it to explain away deities and to explain away transcendent ideas so they could continue to worship their own buttholes.
I mean, you're absolutely correct. And that's a very fascinating point to emphasize as well, is that in the Hellenic traditions, they made some of the most remarkable scientific discoveries. They developed the concept of atomic theory. One of my favorite Hellenic philosophers who actually preceded Socrates, one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, Anaximander, who was only the second recorded philosopher in Western history, developed some of the most incredible scientific discoveries in Western history. He developed the concepts of gravity and of a three-dimensional world, of a heliocentric universe, of evolution, of all these things. But interestingly enough, he also developed this theory of what we call the apeiron, which is Greek for the infinite, the boundless. And the idea behind the apeiron is that it is this eternal substance that permeates throughout all things and grants life to all things, that there is an inherently eternal connotation to life itself. Now, this is reflected in biology. This is reflected via empirically observed fact, because we know, for example, via the law of conservation of mass, matter can be neither created nor destroyed, but it can be converted into another form. Socrates discusses this in Plato's Phaedo when he's talking about this kind of reincarnation, this kind of cyclical life, if you will, that things originate out of their opposites, that life originates from death and likewise death from life, that when a person is in a state of sleep, they will eventually wake from that and vice versa, that things arise out of their opposites. And so he uses this to elaborate upon this point. But interestingly enough, when he's talking about the nature of the soul, and he's discussing what would be more akin to the Pythagorean school of thought in terms of the reincarnation and things like that. There's actually a particular quote that I had here regarding that. When he's talking about what occurs with the soul after it has departed from the body in this place on the underworld, we have a few different places that we discuss in terms of Hellenic theology. We have, for example, the Fields of Elysium, which is kind of, you know, this place in which the souls, which are endowed with immortality and honored by the gods, go. And then we have, in contrast to that, Tartarus, which is this place where this vile and evil presence is, in terms of the souls of people that choose to reject virtue, choose to reject communion with the gods and things of that nature are. So there's kind of this contrast there. But interestingly enough, one of the quotes from Socrates when discussing this is that he says, "The well-ordered and the wise soul is guided throughout the underworld, and they follow the guide, and it is not without familiarity with its surroundings. But the soul that is passionately attached to the body, as I said before, kind of hovers around in the visible world for a long time, struggling and suffering very much until it is led away, and with difficulty by its appointed spirit." So it's kind of like this idea that I envision this as being Ikate, the goddess of the crossroads and transformative periods and phases, and one of the Faunic deities in the underworld. And also, coincidentally, the goddess of Hellenic magic. She's the torchbearer that lights the path and the ways, if so to speak. And when I read this, it was interesting because it elaborates upon this place in the underworld and how there are multiple paths, and one must be guided accordingly through this place. And this idea of this kind of recurrence within the physical body in a state of misery, almost, if you will, because of the attachment to the physical world and this carnal confinement and containment, as opposed to the soul that is released from this and becomes enters into this kind of state of communion with the deities and the gods as a result of a virtuous life and a detachment from this physical world. It's a very interesting thing to discuss, definitely. But that dichotomy is definitely present there in terms of the underworld and the afterlife, definitely.
Yeah, that sounds just like our eschatology, which is, you know, you have Helheim, you go to hell, and you go through the journey of the afterlife, and you know, there's different stories and different stuff that's added to it. Like, for example, they say that there's rivers full of swords and knives, and every good deed that you perform in life acts as a plank so you may cross the river. And then, you know, you go through this whole thing guided by your Hamingya, and you get to the hell thing, which is a meeting where you go before Urd, who is one of the Norns. You don't want to say she's a goddess, but she's kind of like a primordial entity that is in charge of the underworld, but she's also in charge of the past, and she's one of the Norns. She helps weave destiny and fate and stuff like that, and her and the Allfather, and you go before them, and your Hamingya, who's like your, I guess, your spirit guide, or your the spirit overlooks your family, which is kind of like a Fylgja. It's like the same kind of thing. Kind of like speaks on your behalf on your judgment. And what happens at the hell thing is they judge you. They say, hey, all right, you're a good dude. You're a good guy. You did good stuff in life. You are a transcendent being. You weren't attached to materialism and like all of this stuff. You lived in virtue, as you were talking about earlier, virtuous life. So therefore, you get to go to Folkvang, which is kind of like, I guess you could say, Elysium, or a place of rest and peace. And you get to meet with your folk and your family members until it's your time again to be reincarnated and go back to the earth again. But if you're a scumbag, you know, jerk off weirdo, you get sent to Niflhel, which is the bad place. You know?
there's definitely this sense of responsibility and accountability in how we carry ourselves accordingly, and it's good that we have these kind of discussions in terms of the underworld and things of that nature to kind of remind us of that. And you were talking about like the rivers and things like that. We have very similar discussions on those things in Ilanismos with the river of forgetting and the river of suffering and the river of memory and things like that. And it's interesting because Socrates elaborates on this in Phaedo when he's discussing that knowledge in itself is a recollection, in the sense of our souls having been previously familiar with these ideals, these what Plato would call the forms, these perfect, impeccable forms of love and of virtue, of honor and of justice and et cetera, all these things that we strive for. And we struggle throughout this life to manifest these things into the world insofar as we can as mortal beings, to practice these things while resisting the carnal stimulations and interest and instant gratifications and things like that we have. But another very interesting thing is that along the lines of us discussing the problem with hubris, one of the prerequisites that I have found in following the Hellenic path is that one must embark upon this journey that is very similar to that of Persephone when she is taken by Aedes into the underworld. And you're placed in this position that is different from where you were. You were in this initial position of this kind of ignorance and naivety, and almost like an innocent naivety, if you will. And you're swept away into the state of disarray, of this kind of chaotic disaster, or so it appears. And you're put through this trial, so to speak, if you will. When I think about this in terms of the mythos, I look at Heracles, who is one of obviously the most amazing Greek heroes that we provide reverence to and provide offerings to. And when you look at his life, when he was presented with the two paths, he was visited by virtue and vice. And he was offered the first path, which is this path of vice, this path of instant gratification and satisfaction in the physical world and contentment and complacency and pleasure in these things. But there's no glory in that. There's no spiritual wealth or satisfaction in that. And then he was presented with this second path of virtue. And he was warned this would be a path wrought with tragedy, trial, and tribulation and difficulty, but only in overcoming trial and tribulation and difficulty and troubles would he reach a state of triumph. And it's this realization, as I said earlier, that the gods do not grant us glory in itself, but rather the weapons with which to fight for it. If I've learned anything in my own personal experience and kind of reciprocal relationship with Goddess Athena, with the goddess of wisdom and warfare, it's precisely that you will be presented the weapons with which to fight for these things, but you prove your sincerity and your devotion to these gods. You prove your worth in that sense. And I look at Heracles as an example of that, and in having to endure such tragedy, to be broken down, to see oneself in a state of disarray, to destroy what is in order to rebuild, in this image of virtue, to kind of slay this hydra of hubris, as I prefer to call it, and instead pursue Erete in this perfect form of virtue and these spiritual values, is ultimately the goal of the Hellenist. And it seems that many people that follow this path, whether they be an Odinist or whether they follow the Asatru traditions or Hellenismos or irrespective, go through very similar things. And we learn in these difficulties to triumph, to find glory in the struggle. And ultimately, I think that becomes kind of a prerequisite for many people upon this path. But it also weeds out those who possess this arrogance and this hubris, who want instead to gain power rather than to pursue virtue. And that kind of seems to me to be the culling, if you will, of those who are sincere, and set them apart from those who simply follow this for the sake of provocation or attention or for the pursuit of personal power.
Yeah, that's incredible. I just can't get over how many parallels that are going on right now. You're talking about how in a state of piety is what you should strive for, and you should get rid of people that are individualist, get rid of people that are selfish, and people that are using this for their own gains. Because obviously that stuff's profane. You know, I mean, I'm like you. I'm getting to the point that it's these people that kind of just, they LARP and they use this and then they inject all this like kind of profane garbage. I'm getting so tired of them. And it's just, it really kind of distorts what our faiths are all about with these Indo-European. And, you know, the parallels aren't a coincidence. You know, these all hail from the same root, whether you're talking Hellenismos, you're talking, you know, Asatru and Sedianism, or you're talking all the way over in Sanatana Dharma. And we have universal principles. We believe in piety. We believe in harmony with the cosmos. We believe in living in virtue. We believe in, you know, the afterlife. We believe in hierology. We believe in all of these things. And the fact that there's so many parallels isn't a coincidence at all, because it shows to me that it's not just comparative studies, it's not just these people talk to these people, it's truth to me, and it's evidence to me that these things are true, that this is evidence that these principles are true. Even though the gods are different, even though the wording's different, even though some of the philosophies are different, the core principles are very, very similar. And to me, in my mind, that just shows that we are on the right path and we are speaking truth and we are practicing genuine religions that are that adhere to real gods. So that's something, you know, I can't get over that enough. You know, these are real deities. This is a real authentic tradition that we're practicing, that we're bringing back to life. Now, before we go, because we're getting close to the end here, we do an hour show. Before we go too far into the philosophies and stuff, which we could, I would love to talk to you about it all night, but I want to get into some of the more pragmatic stuff. What are the holidays of Hellenism?
Well, they're very similar to many of the ones that you practice as well in Asatru. And that's the interesting thing, is you're talking about many of the commonalities and things of that nature. And there definitely are universal ones in that sense as well, in terms of our ritualistic celebrations. And of course, we have the more traditional ones. We have the ones that have been adopted into the more mainstream that even Christianity acknowledges, and the celebrations of Saturnalia and all these things. But a lot of the really crucial ones revolve around particular events, as in, like yesterday, for example, was representative of goddess Athena becoming the patron goddess of Athens. And these various kind of celebrations that we have pertaining to events like that, that are very prominent to each of the gods. And of course, in addition to that, the celebrations of the new moon and the celebrations of these things, those are the most kind of integral and important in terms of our celebrations. But there's also the fact that the ancient Greeks had so many celebrations and things of that nature. And a lot of those practices are now kind of confined to a more localized practice. And that's a bit unfortunate, because so many of them, as I said earlier, are very much contingent upon more of like the citywide practices and the celebration of Athens when they embraced those ritualistic practices and things of that nature, celebrating like with goddess Athena, with the establishment of her as the patron goddess of the city and things like that. So a lot of the rituals that we practice now are more of a localized things in terms of the different celebrations that we have. And there are so many of them, really, from ancient times and antiquity, that we simply don't have the means to practice all of them. And also that's because we don't quite have the same communal sense that they had during that period of time, which is unfortunate. But definitely we have a different kind of year laid out in the Hellenic year. We look at it as beginning in July rather than in January. So we look at it that way. And in terms of the celebrations, we mostly focus on those kind of events pertaining to the different historical, like mythos and things like that, and particular ones of that nature. So it primarily revolves around that. And then we also have, as I say, like the new moon ceremonies and things like that. But there are quite literally so many of them. There are particular pages dedicated just to discussing them because there are so many. Every single day, almost every single month, we have so many different days representative of different iconic Hellenic moments. So that's something that would actually require a further elaboration and conversation, because it's a very complex topic for us. It's not just five or six. It's literally a plethora of different celebrations. But yeah, there's a long, extensive list.
That's fascinating, though. But do you guys still have, because in in Austro-Hunseticism, we very much have like the core four, which is the two equinoxes, and then we have the two solstices. Is that the same?
Yes, we have those as well. They're all very prominent as pertaining to the solar deities in terms of Apollo and Helios, and likewise on the reverse of that with the new moon ceremonies with Hecate and Selene and all those kind of things. So there's that dichotomy. But yes, those are definitely prominent with the solstices and the equinoxes. But the beautiful thing about Hellenic celebrations is that it truly is a continual celebration. It is a continual practice. And that's what makes it such a profound thing, is it's not just the primary four, but it's really just so much more. As I said, we have pages on Facebook and on social media that talk about just daily the representations of that day, the representations in terms of the different Hellenic events and celebrations and things. And it's just a continual kind of celebration, if you will. The way that I interpret many of these things is that really it's just as if everything that we do becomes a testament to the gods in that way. It is literally a way of life. And I'm sure it's very similar in Austria. But it's almost as if, you know, every single day we have something that we recognize, something that we celebrate. And to remain in this state in which we see all of our actions as being a testament to the gods and in a celebration, in an exaltation of them, in this kind of permanent state of spiritual ecstasy, is a very beautiful thing. And I'm sure it's very similar in many ways in Austria.
Yeah, absolutely. We the names of the week are named after the old Germanic gods. I'm sure you're aware of that. So, well, except for Saturday. That's Saturn. That's your boy. But so if people want to check out more and they want to maybe check out some organizations or something like that, where can they go to? Because, you know, in Austria, we have the Austro Folk Assembly. We have the Odinic Rite. We have Neurona Society. Right. We have there's so many of us. There's a lot of us. But right. If people want to go check out and see what's going on with the, you know, the Hellenismos side of things, where can they find an organization either here in the States or abroad? Is there a good website for good resources? How would you suggest somebody that's interested? And is there, you know, also in another question I wanted to have before we finish up here. In the Germanic tradition, we believe very much in, you know, and ancestry. Do you have to be Greek or Mediterranean to practice Hellenismos?
You do not have to be ethnically Greek to practice it. We consider it to be something that is transcendent in one sense, although we very much emphasize the importance of acknowledging and presenting a reverence of the traditions as far as the ethnic identity goes. One does not have to be Greek in order to practice it, because as many Greek philosophers actually discussed on this topic, it's very much a state of mind. It's very much a way of life and a practice in that sense. However, understanding the importance of ancestry is also very, very important. And for that reason, there's actually a specific form of libation that we offer in rituals. And it's actually very similar to the ones that we offer to the Thonic deities in the underworld that is also dedicated to the ancestors. So that is something that is very, very important to acknowledge. In terms of sources on Hellenismos, we don't have quite as many in terms of ones that are here in the United States. However, we do have like the United Hellenismos Association and things like that. But there are also some really good websites as well I can send you that we can link in the comments as well. That would be really good on this topic. There's becoming increasingly a greater and more prominent interest in Elonismos. And it's something that I've noticed this year in particular. A lot of people have been messaging me, inquiring about it, and I'm seeing more groups pop up on Facebook. There's several pertaining to this particular topic. And on social media in general, there's just kind of a growing interest in the discussions of Elonismos. And that's a really beautiful thing for me to see. But there are a lot of groups on it. There are a lot of websites that are really constructive on this. And I can actually send those to you as well, so we can post those in the comments. Because there's a pretty good amount of resources out there. So,
very, very cool. And where can people find your individual content? I know you have a YouTube channel. I know that you're a big hit on Facebook. Where can everybody find you at?
Primarily on Facebook. That's where I'm putting out most of my work now. It's just under my name, under Sydney Horton. And then my YouTube channel is under Bay Southern Bell. And most of my content up until this point has been political, obviously, but it's really beginning to transition into a more cultural, philosophical, and religious discussion. And I'm very glad I've made that transformative decision. It's been a positive one overall. But yeah, I'm primarily on Facebook and YouTube. So those are the two main places you guys can find my work. So.
And real quick, why'd you get out of politics, and why you coming over to the spiritual side of things?
Honestly, I entered into politics because I felt that it was kind of a moral imperative to discuss it. But when I really started contemplating on why politics was something that I felt that I had to be involved in, it was because I began to perceive in a way that I see politics as being a lens through which we perceive the health of our culture and our civilization. But when I began to see politics as it is discussed in the modern day, it's just this kind of bickering about very superficial aspects of politics. It's about the arguments between politicians and policies and economic systems and all these other things. So irrespective of where one lies on the political spectrum, I do not feel that politics serves the main objective that most people get involved in it with. And that objective is to kind of create a communal identity and a sense of purpose and belonging. Politics does not fulfill that at all in a substantial way in the modern day. It's just very much a tool of polarizing, and it's very counterproductive to the purpose that we have as polytheists, as people that are concerned with the preservation of Western civilization. It's really just a very polarizing thing that I do not feel actually serves any tangible or sustainable or substantial cultural influence in terms of what we're attempting to accomplish in preserving the West. I mean, it doesn't accomplish these things. I think that it's really counterproductive to that endeavor. So for that reason, I've kind of stepped away from it and said, you know, I still will discuss these things in terms of kind of a moral obligation, because again, it's a reflection of the cultural health of society. But ultimately, no amount of policies, no economic system, no president, no politician will actually be able to save our culture if we do not start addressing cultural concerns rather than exclusively political ones. So that's why I kind of have made that transition. And I'm fully, like, just encouraged at the response that I've got in doing so. Because people overall, I think, are beginning to realize politics in itself is not sufficient.
Yeah, I've said from day one, even when I was completely entrenched in politics, and I remember back when, I'm sure you remember, I used to do the Mad American Network and like all that stuff. I remember there were times that I was on live stream and I would have my Mjolnir out, and people would say, they would ask me, what's that? What's your necklace? And I would say, oh, that's religious stuff. And I would hide it and I would put it away because I didn't want to talk about it. And I thought that politics was where we should. And now I realize that the way forward, what I think is the most potent weapon that we can use, not only want to say weapon, the most potent tool that we can use to heal our people and to go towards a better tomorrow for our children and our people and our folk is this, our spiritual identity. And it's this whole time has been, you know, right next to my heart, hanging around my neck. And that's kind of what I want to go to. There's so many people that are talking about politics now. They're doing a better job than I ever did. So I wanted to give people something different. I want to talk about something that I really love and I'm really passionate about. And I'm sure, you know, you've done political commentary for so long, it rots you out. You start feeling like a circus clown or something. Sometimes you get to the point that it's just like you don't want to talk about, you can't talk about anything that's, you know, I guess like controversial or going to ruffle feathers, even though you're thinking of it, because your audience is going to react bad against it. It's going to hurt your algorithms, and then your next video you put out isn't going to get as many views, and you get pigeonholed into just kind of just parroting and regurgitating things, and it just rots you out. That's my experience. I don't know if you can feel that.
I definitely do. And I feel that it's counterproductive and completely antithetical to how I feel when I'm discussing like things like this. Like, our conversation is by far much more encouraging and invigorating than any political discussions that I have. And that's because I simply don't see anything constructive coming out of those discussions. I don't see it inspiring anyone to seek a better and more constructive life for themselves or for their family, or to address cultural issues. I see it as people simply bickering about issues that are presented to them in an immediate fashion by the media, because it's a distraction. It's to keep you from reaching the state of self-awareness in which you're beginning to turn your eyes upward and say, I want to see something change in culture, in society, in civilization, something that these other issues are not in any way, shape, or form addressing. So definitely, I do really relate to that on a deep level.
Would you say that politics is anus worship?
Yes.
I love it. I love it. All right, Ms. Horton, we're going to shut it down for this evening. Thank you so much for coming on. This is a wonderful interview. We'll have you on again very, very soon. And everybody go make sure you check out Ms. Horton, Bass Southern Belle. She's all over Facebook. Just type in her name. You'll find her. She's got all kinds of audience and stuff. She's a big smash hit. You guys are going to love her. You're going to love her content. I'm really excited to see her content moving forward when she gets into the Hellenic stuff, because as I mentioned earlier in the show, it's an area that I'm not very familiar with. And given that I got a little bit of Paisan in me, I should go look into it and, you know, understand what my Italian ancestors believed, and, you know, maybe some of that stuff. So I'm really excited to see that going forward, and we're going to make sure we're going to check you out. And everybody go check her out, give her a like and a share and subscribe. Speaking of like, share, and subscribe, make sure you like, share, subscribe here, Roffin Folk Network. So help us beat the YouTube, Google algorithms and all that crap that shuts us down. Like, subscribe, share, click the little alert buttons. You're going to alert every time we go live, whether it's here on the Bog every single Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern with me and my buddy, my co-host, Mr. Angriff, whether it's Tuesdays, God's Folk and Destiny with the mighty Stephen McNallan, or it's Fridays with Hen House, or Saturdays with Folkstead. That includes my buddy, Mr. Rory, and his co-host, Sig. They're going to be back very soon. Mr. Rory had a big move. He moved all the way across the country, so he's going to be back next week. We got so much awesome stuff, whether it's Tuesdays, Kaiser Cooks. We got Miss Barbie Chan doing stuff. Man, we have so many wonderful programs here on Roffin Folk Network. We work very hard to bring you guys good, wholesome, traditional, spiritual content. So make sure you like, subscribe, share here, and we will see you next week. Before we head out, like always, I'm going to give a shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving the vampires your money. The serpents, the cold ones, they hate your guts. They sell you poison. Stop giving them your money. Support folk economy. Give your money to somebody that loves you, that cares about you, that makes a good, wholesome, organic product that's made out of real stuff that grows from the earth. There's no plastics in here. There's no synthetics in here. There's nothing in here that trashes your body. Our folk, our ancestors gifted us with such wonderful, beautiful features and complexions. So make sure you keep your white bright, keep your beard robust, and keep your mane flowing like Big Dave. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. I'll see you guys next week. Thanks again, Miss Horton. I'll see you very, very soon. I'll talk to you soon. I'll see you all, you guys, next week. And all you people that sent me blessings when I was sick in the hospital, man, I love you guys, man. Many blessings, much love to all you guys and your wonderful, beautiful families. Hail the gods, hail the folk, hail victory. I'll see you guys next week. Take care.